there's the flip side of the deal, which, yeah, you can, as an individual, use Sora to generate things with Disney images, but Disney is going to stream these kind of videos. So they're going right back to Disney, and they're trying to basically have control in some way of that fan-generated content and have it come back to Disney instead of proliferating on X or Blue Sky. So they're trying to say that before this gets into a whole, oh yeah, look at all these wonderful fan-generated shorts. No, 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 come be on our platform instead.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of charming and brilliant minds in technology to distill down what's important in the latest news in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists. We've got Martin Keane, Master Inventor, Marina Danilevsky, Senior Research Scientist, and Kushvarshni, IBM Fellow. The year is winding up, but it's still full of AI news. We're going to be covering Disney and OpenAI's new licensing deal, the Time Magazine Person of the Year, Nemotron 3, the new NVIDIA launch, and this Claude Sol document. But first, we've got Eileen with the news.
Hi, I'm Eileen McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. Here are a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. 2025 has been the year that driverless cars have gone mainstream. Google, Amazon, and Tesla each launched their own version of these robo-taxis in various U.S. cities. Walmart has moved from the New York Stock Exchange to NASDAQ, a move illustrating the retail giant is trying to transform into an AI-powered enterprise. IBM and online platform Kaggle have partnered to create a new leaderboard that evaluates AI models and agents as they solve real-world enterprise issues. It's official. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary has declared its word of the year for 2025, slop, the term used for poor quality AI-generated content. For more, subscribe to the Think newsletter linked in the show notes. And now let's go back to our experts.
I want to begin today's episode by talking about the Disney OpenAI deal, which was just announced this past week. So this is sort of an interesting one. I know at this point we're all kind of very cynical about deals that are less than, you know, $10 billion. But the core of this deal basically is that Disney is about to sign a 3-year licensing deal with OpenAI to allow its characters and IP to be used in its generative kind of AI models. Additionally, Disney is going to be taking what is effectively kind of like a $1 billion stake in OpenAI itself and become an equity owner. And so I guess maybe, Martin, I'll kick it off with you. Why is OpenAI signing this deal exactly?
Yeah, it's such an interesting deal, isn't it, Tim? Because traditionally, the sort of generative AI deals that we've seen up until now have been for training and grounding purposes. So you would purchase, for example, a bunch of news articles. So OpenAI did a deal with Financial Times for that, and Google did a deal with Reddit where they pay Reddit, I think, $60 million a year for the Reddit training data. But this isn't that, but this is the other end of it. This is taking the finished model and actually using the output of it to be able to incorporate the characters in, which is a really different way of looking at it. And I think from one perspective, you can think, well, as soon as a new image model comes out, people are trying to generate copyrighted material instantly with it and seeing how much the model lets you get away with. And often over time, they kind of...
Yeah, I think one of my first Sora uses was like Mickey Mouse cartoon.
Exactly. So, might as well do it officially, right? I guess maybe that's one of Disney's perspectives. But this has really got me thinking, what other deals we might see beyond this if this one works out for Disney and OpenAI. Like, whenever a new model comes out today, there's always the same sort of tests that everybody does on the model. Like, you always see people try to build a vector image of a pelican riding a bike to see how good each model is, right? Or an otter on a plane using Wi-Fi is another pretty popular one. I have my own one of those, which is every time a new model comes out that's supposed to be good at writing, I have it generate a Nelson DeMille short story in the style of Nelson DeMille. And it's not bad, but always it comes through and says, I can't write in the style of Nelson DeMille. But here is something similar to it that includes some of the themes. It's like a disclaimer, right? But maybe not in future. Maybe in future, authors will kind of consent as well. And then I could like make fan fiction of my favorite authors. Who knows where this is going?
Possible, yeah. And I guess, Marina, I think one of the things that comes to mind is, you know, with Disney, they've got, you know, the most frustrating thing for Disney for a long time is they've had like the vault, right? Where they're like, you can only access certain movies at certain times. And then arbitrarily at certain times, Disney is like, it's in the vault. You can't get access to it. It's a long way of saying, I think like Disney's very protective of these characters and this IP. So them to say like, yeah, we're okay with a world where anyone's going to use generative AI to, you know, have Mickey Mouse do whatever. The Mickey Mouse is a bad case because it's like now entering kind of more public domain. What's your thinking on like why Disney's finally willing to take this risk? Because it's kind of a big deal for them in terms of how they think about and control their intellectual property.
It is. And Bob Iger did say something about this is kind of coming anyway, so we want to get ahead of it instead of fall prey to it. And something that I just want to mention is there's the flip side of the deal, which, yeah, you can, as an individual, use Sora to generate things with Disney images, but Disney is going to stream these kind of videos. So they're going right back to Disney, and they're trying to basically have control in some way of that fan-generated content and have it come back to Disney instead of proliferating on X or Blue Sky or wherever you're going to be. So they're trying to say that before this gets into a whole, oh yeah, look at all these wonderful fan-generated shorts. No, 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 come be on our platform instead. So this also reads to me to a large extent like a platform play where they're like, look, this is going to happen anyway. So let's make sure that people are doing these things on our platform and constantly coming back to that much tighter integration with Disney Plus. So that seemed to be an important part of it to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, Kush, this sort of opens up like, I think what is kind of like a really strange world, right? Is like, you just turn on like the Disney Channel at some point and it's just like infinite user-generated AI cartoons of these characters, right? Is that kind of seems like where we're headed.
Yeah, I think it is. And for these diehard listeners of the podcast, I mean, maybe last year at some point I was mentioning Foucault and the author function and how, I mean, the whole social contract of authorship is maybe changing and stuff. And I think that's exactly it, right? When you have these thousands or millions or billions of fan fiction out there, the social contract is just completely different now. It's like, before, in these oral cultures and stuff, you had these bards singing. They were kind of, I mean, not trying to make money off of it. They were shepherds or farmers or shopkeepers or whatever, and they were just doing it for their own status, kind of, and or continuing a tradition. And then with blogs and stuff, this digital orality kind of came about again. And now with the AI tools, I think Disney's just going to capture exactly that same sort of social contract. So as Marina was saying, I mean, be ahead of the game and just be part of where the world is headed, because I think they're still going to make their money on the amusement parks and the merchandise licensing and all of that sort of stuff. So just like whatever authorship is turning into, I think they just are part of it too.
Martin, where does this all go ultimately? You know, now that kind of Disney has been willing to jump in, you know, I assume everybody else who owns significant IP is also kind of thinking, well, is this my time to get in and cash in on some of this stuff to build a partnership with these AI companies? Yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on like basically like where this goes next.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, Tim, this completely flips the script, because, you know, LLMs come out, everybody's thinking, hey, how did this get trained? Did it train on my data? Do I need to sue to get my data paid for and so forth? Now, this is the exact opposite. Disney are paying $1 billion in an equity investment to OpenAI with more to come. So it's completely the opposite way around. So I think this really signals to everybody else, if you have IP and you're not able to generate it in Sora, are you missing out? Like, are the eyeballs now going to go more to the Disney IP and not to your own IP? So yeah, we may even see kind of the complete reverse of what we've seen before, where everybody is kind of pushing to get their content into these models now.
Yeah. And I think, Marina, I think that was like one thing I want to note end this sort of segment on is, you know, obviously Disney's Disney, right? One of the biggest, most powerful content companies in the world. Do you have any thoughts on what this means if you're just like, I don't know, someone creating art online? You know, because I feel like they're in a very different position, right, from, you know, someone who happens to own, you know, the rights to Harry Potter or something like that.
I was going to say K-pop demon hunters get back to me when...
Yes, that's right.
Ruby playing with my daughter who's obsessed right now. But I could imagine other content owners following suit and seeing what this is. I mean, I wonder to what extent... I know it's an exclusive license for a year or so. What are they going to do? Are they going to be in a fight with Google or Meta or whoever for a year for using their content? Are we going to be chopping things up again? Are we going to see more mergers of this kind of thing? I think there's a lot of economics here that are really interesting and very much not worked out, like what Kush said. The contract with creators and what counts as official and what counts as unofficial, that line's going to be way harder to tell. And I think that there's going to be a lot of people involved in that in the next few years trying to draw those lines.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Super useful getting all your opinions on it. So I'm going to move us on to our next segment. Time Magazine, as you all know, has an annual Person of the Year feature that they do. And this year's Person of the Year is not a person, but in fact, the architects of AI. And so if you've seen the magazine cover, it's a take on a kind of classic image of construction in New York, but it's sort of all of the kind of various luminaries of AI sitting on like a construction girder. And I thought this is so interesting and worth spending some time on because it lets us talk a little bit about sort of what's been happening this year in AI, but also just how the media representation of AI is evolving. I think the big first thing that stood out to me was, you know, you have CEOs and infrastructure providers, kind of not a whole lot of researchers are represented here.
Yeah. I think Lisa Su was on there, which I think was surprising for people. Former IBM researcher, by the way.
Yeah. Got to get that name checked.
Exactly. I think having the CEOs on there really—that's the signal. I mean, architects of AI, like, what are they architecting, right? I think it's the financial aspects, the hype, the business. I mean, that's what's being architected. And if they had chosen to feature, the scientists or even the data workers, I mean, that would have been a very impactful sort of cover. But just capitalism is forefronted. I mean, that's what architecture means, I think. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, I'm not going to comment on that, but I think that's the message at least.
Marina, does... this is going to be a very pointed question for someone like you. Does research matter anymore? You know, I mean, in the sense that basically, like, Time Magazine is saying, and I think it does kind of capture something which is fundamental about the moment in AI, which is almost all the action, all the attention is on the business side, right? And so I guess I'm really curious about kind of how you feel about sort of like this balance of power, I guess, between like the folks advancing like the actual technical research and then I guess this like increasingly large ecosystem, which is important, no doubt, but, you know, almost kind of sits almost entirely aside from some of what's happening, you know, on the latest papers from NeurIPS or what have you.
I really, really agree with what Kush said, is that this is a signal that it hasn't been as much the year of AI as it's been the year of AI hype. AI communication, AI as business, AI as the financial deals, not necessarily so much the technical side of things. I mean, look, that's interesting. It's continuing. But also people were saying that 2025 was going to be the year where AI agents put all of us out of work. Not quite there, guys. Still getting there, still working on it. But the hype this year, the stories, the way that people talked about it was ridiculous. And a lot of it really centered on these cults of personality, these who could say the most ridiculous things in the news and move the coverage as ping pong balls from, oh, now it's this company. No, it's back here. No, it's back here. No, it's back here. So it's certainly a year of that. And, you know, I also, like Kush, I'm not completely sure what to make of it. It's reflective of reality. It's maybe not reflective of where the real work and the interesting technical work is happening, but you can't deny the reality of the business and the what people are actually talking about, which, yeah, it has been this, for better or worse.
Yeah, it has been the hype, basically. Martin, thoughts on this? I'm hearing some grumbles, maybe, from your other panelists.
No, I'm totally on board with what you're saying there, Marina. It does seem like the year of AI hype would be the tag for this, rather than the year of the agent, perhaps. But, I mean, look, the article points out how much of this focuses on infrastructure, how much it's been on infrastructure this year, how much spending there is, just raw spending on AI data centers and so forth. They mentioned in the article over $400 billion in 2025 just on kind of AI activities, which is a you know, a huge amount. So the article kind of made the point that are these like the next industrial titans? You know, we had the railroads and so forth, and now it's the data center. Is this kind of the next thing? And I think a lot of the focus is on that. Now, when I saw that the, you know, this year it was kind of this AI was the focus, the person of the year, I thought, oh, that seems a bit cute. And then I went back and had a look at some of the other Time magazine persons of the year. And this is certainly not the first time it has not been an actual person. And do you know who the person of the year in 1982 was?
No, I do not.
It was the computer, popularized by the IBM PC. So we've kind of gone circle from, hey, everyone has a computer now, to, hey, now everyone has access to AI 2025.
I don't know if you can top 2006, you. Yeah. There was just a mirror.
Yeah, you. That's right. The mirror one. Yeah. I'm going to move us to kind of our next topic. This was one I was joking a few weeks ago. I was like, I am tired because it feels like every few weeks we do a segment, which is a new model's out. What do you think about it? And in fact, like the end result, I forget who commented on a previous episode. Like the end result is basically like there's a lot of models coming out all the time. They're all really good. And, you know, after a while, kind of like a lot of the distinctions tend to blend into one another. But we're going to do a segment on this. So NVIDIA launched its newest generation of its Nemotron open source models, Nemotron 3. And there's a lot of stuff that we've kind of come to expect from some of the model releases that are coming out in the last few months. They're focusing a lot more on agentic behavior. There's a spread of models from the very largest to the smallest. And there's a bunch of kind of infrastructure and other kind of component accessories they've released with this generation of models. I do want to get into that, but I think I want to start a little bit with just like a business question for some of our listeners. Kush, I guess I have a question of just basically like, why isn't NVIDIA always winning when it releases its models? Like, doesn't it have the ability to create models that are ultra optimized for their own hardware that everybody else runs on? And so kind of is implicitly, like, doesn't it make sense that like the Nemotron models would be, you know, some of the most successful models out there? But that doesn't really seem to be the case, right? We tend to focus on a lot of other players in the space for their models. And so I guess I'm kind of curious if you can account for NVIDIA being this huge hardware leader, but I think arguably, you know, and I think realistically is not necessarily like a model leader.
Yeah, maybe now they will be actually. So I think they've been kind of, moving up the stack. I mean, starting as a GPU company and then having the CUDA. And then, I mean, part of this announcement was actually an acquisition of ShedMD. And this is workload management sort of scheduling sort of software and stuff like that. And so, I mean, they keep moving up the stack. They're kind of like consolidating everything as they go. And I think they're really just, it's like a snowball, like rolling down the hill. It's just adding more and more and more and becoming this this big juggernaut. And a long time ago, I did an internship at Sun Microsystems. And the key phrase for them was, the network is the computer. So this was John Gage, I think, was the person who came up with this. And I think they're just like rolling up to becoming like, I mean, NVIDIA, the AI stack is the computer. And I think that's how it is. And they're kind of controlling the narrative going forward as well. So I think we just need to keep an eye on like what comes next, where else do they go?
Yeah, so you're actually saying this is actually a pretty big deal. I shouldn't necessarily shrug off like, Nemotron 3, much like Nemotron 2, what's another model? You actually think this is actually significant in some ways?
Maybe. I mean, you can say that maybe the models are being commoditized in some fashion. So what they're doing is probably the same recipe that that others are doing, that we're doing. I mean, on the Granite 4 architecture, is pretty much the same. So maybe it's just like yeah, I mean, connecting everything together is the thing.
Marina, if you agree with Kush, there's almost kind of like a fun, interesting race going on, right? It seems like, which is like, NVIDIA moving up the stack, trying to gobble everybody. At the same time, everybody's trying to like get off of NVIDIA onto other hardware platforms. I don't know. Do you agree with Kush's assessment? Where does this all go in your mind?
I think I definitely do agree with Kush. And the full stack play is something that has been going on. You're right. People coming from different ends, either coming from the bottom or from the top and trying to do it. Because the quality of these models by themselves has gotten very comparable. Now that it matters so much more, the levels of integration, the levels of distillation that you can do for specific things. How do you integrate them together? How do you test things for yourself, see if this works for you or not? When everything gets commoditized like this, it certainly turns once again much more into, okay, what's the economic play here? And also, what's the ease of use? I think people's expectations for ease of use and ease of trying it out is very, very, very high. So I think that also NVIDIA doesn't want to be dependent on other people to choose it or to not choose it. So they are necessarily getting ahead of the game. I think this makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, they're not the only ones that are doing this. So I think it makes a lot of sense what they're doing.
Martin, you may have comments on this. I think one question also just throw into the mix is, I think a meta story of 2025 is, what are the bounds of kind of like an open release in the space? And it feels like that's kind of one of the questions that's playing, where people like used to say, oh, well, we just released the model. And now people are like, well, the model and the data. And NVIDIA is here because they're also releasing, a couple training data sets and reinforcement learning libraries. It feels like, if anything, like the scope of open is getting broader and broader and broader about like what's expected when you do one of these open releases. And curious if you have thoughts on the trends there or anything that Kush and Marina just said.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the openness is going to expand a lot, especially with the EU AI Act coming in next year. That's going to require things like stating what your training data set is and so forth. So, that's a big open thing that is not discussed, even with many open models. So that's interesting. Now, Tim, you made the point of, why do NVIDIA not have the best model? Because they have the GPUs. Shouldn't it just be easy to, combine the two? But it's interesting, if you think about what is probably the top rated frontier model right now, is probably Gemini 3 Pro, right? And that was trained on exactly zero NVIDIA GPUs. So Google have had the advantage of using their own hardware. They trained the entire model on TPUs, and it was a massive pre-training effort as well. I mean, the most of the work seemed to go into the pre-training. So that's an example where owning the hardware and building the model has really worked out very well, because Google has just been able to make such advances with that. So it will be interesting to see how these NVIDIA models come along as well.
I guess, Kush, anything you'd want to flag in terms of, model architecture or otherwise? I know this is, again, sort of multi-agent, like what everybody else is kind of doing, but anything unique you think you'd worth pointing out?
No, I mean, again, on the narrative point, like the architecture is this hybrid. It has a bunch of transformer layers. It has some Mamba layers, which is a state space sort of model for long-range dependencies, and a mixture of experts. So our name of our podcast in there. But that combination is like the hype, again, is kind of saying that, this is something unique and new and great. And it can deliver all sorts of performance and efficiency and make sense for agents and stuff. And all of that is true. I would completely agree with it. But it's not like they're the first to come out with it. So I think all of this is, coming back to the Time magazine thing, right? I mean, it's like, what are you centering? It's the hype of it, in addition to like the fundamentals.
Yeah, that architecture, that sounds an awful lot like Granite 4, doesn't it, Kush? The Mamba, yeah. And the transformer, yeah. And the mixture of experts all together. Yeah.
Everybody's been very on message today. We've got lots of IBM references coming in. I guess, Martin, I'm on a final note on that. Do you want to do any comparison between this and Granite?
The actual architecture itself, as I was reading, I was like, hold on. Am I reading the NVIDIA one, or am I reading
the
Granite one? Because it's awfully familiar. And they have the same idea of multiple models as well, which I think a lot of these open models are moving to now. So they have Nano, Super, and Ultra, where they have 30 billion is Nano and 500 billion is Ultra. But because it's a mixture of experts model, you only use about 1/10 of those parameters at inference time. So that 30 billion model, the Nano model, actually only uses 3 billion active parameters at inference time. So it does mean that you can take these models and run them on some pretty small devices, which I think is quite interesting.
I'm going to move us on to our final topic of the day. So this is a fun story, actually, from a number of weeks back. We had scheduled to talk about it when the news had broke, but just there's been so much other things happening in AI that we're only addressing it now, you know, towards the end of December. But I did think it was a pretty interesting story, and it's a way to talk about what's happening in model alignment and model safety. So kind of a fun little sort of disclosure happened. A kind of independent researcher was digging around with Claude and sort of uncovered a document that is used in the training process that Anthropic calls its Claude, quote, soul document. And what the soul document is basically it's a very long sort of manifesto of sorts of how the company wants Claude to behave under a wide range of circumstances. And it's kind of unique in a couple ways. You know, I think the way the document is drafted is a lot more sort of narrative and philosophical than a lot of safety documents that you might have seen that said, look, here's a long list of things that we don't want the model to do. Maybe I'll turn to Marina. What should we make of Claude having a quote, soul document? And what exactly is going on here from a technical standpoint? Like, what is this actually being used for?
So I think it's very in line with, you know, Anthropic's perspective and the way that they want people to think about how they develop their models and their company. And I mean, I like Claude. I've always kind of liked the Claude model. I like the way they write and what they do. I think that something that's interesting here actually is that this document, if I understood the coverage correctly, is being used at fine-tuning time, not just something that's injected in the prompt. And this is interesting because it's different than I think what a lot of other models do, which is just do a whole bunch of fine-tuning or RL techniques that don't have any kind of framing around the examples. The example is just here's a really specific task, really specific question, and then this answer is better than that answer. I'm simplifying, but you know, you keep going kind of that way. And not having anything around that of, oh, and you should think about how to answer this in this way, in reference to this, in reference to this, in reference to this. So as a result of doing it during that time, earlier in the stack, think of it that way, this means that this is reinforced over and over and over and over again in sort of the model's own parameters. Now, yes, calling it a soul document is cute, but there is a sense of, you know, almost like a value and a structure of no matter what the task is, you ought to be referencing a whole bunch of things beyond just the concrete question and answer. And I think there's something in that. And what I think is the case is that a lot of people maybe do that without being so explicit about it, where because of the default system prompt that you choose to have or not have as you train your model, you kind of maybe have your own version of that document, but it's maybe very small and it's maybe not very intentional. Whereas it does seem like what they have in Anthropic, it has been deployed in that sense very intentionally. It does result in a somewhat different personality of a model because you end up building different biases. And I use that word in a technical sense. I think it's just a slightly different perspective on when do you put this information sort of into the model, earlier up the stack. And that itself, I think, is worth looking into how much of a difference that makes.
Yeah, and I kind of offered a question, I guess, Marina, which you'll probably have the answer to, is like, why haven't we done sort of model alignment in this way before? Like, why have we leaned so much on prompting versus just like working it into the fine tuning? Because I think what you're saying is really true, right? Which is, well, we kind of want this set of principles kind of embedded into the behavior of the model. But I think the fine tuning thing is like a little bit different from how a lot of people do it.
Yeah, maybe Kush will have perspective on this as well. But I think that one thing is that it becomes a little bit more difficult to do things from an evaluation perspective of like, well, if you have all of these things as also part of what you're going after, can you really tell that this particular answer that you're offering is actually better than that particular answer that you're offering? I wonder how much time they spent not only on figuring out this document, but figuring out how they need to change their training data in order to account that they're actually training in line with what is there. Because most of the time, we don't do that. And then the data sets that we rely on or that we construct don't do that. They're a little bit more straightforward. They're a little bit more focused, or actually a lot more focused than that.
As we've been doing this for granted, I mean, we've built up that experience as well for kind of the safety alignment or morality alignment or whatever have you. And I think the evaluation is clearly, I mean, part of this, like, how do you know which behavior is preferred or not and these sort of things. But I think there's also the modularity question, because once you do the supervised fine-tuning or similar sort of fine-tuning sort of things, it's like fully baked in. And not every use case is exactly the same, especially for the types of customers and use cases that we often think about. So it's just, I mean, maybe like too heavy-handed in some fashion, because like Anthropic, I mean, they're in their thing, I mean, it states that they want this to be like an expert friend of some kind. And not every LLM should be your expert friend. So breaking it up, kind of having the options to turn things on and off, do things in the way that makes sense for your use case, I think is another driving factor.
Yeah, totally. And I think these trade-offs get very interesting. I mean, Marina, your comment about like, oh, they're actually giving up some evaluation ability by doing it this way is like pretty interesting, right? They're kind of like, well, we have a harder time measuring this. I don't know if this is what you meant, but it's like we have a harder time measuring this, but we think it's more aligned if we do it this way. Yeah. Martin, I think Marina was being pretty nice about this, but I think one of my instincts on reading this was like, wow, this is like so Anthropic. This is a very Anthropic-y, this is like the most Anthropic-y document I've ever read. And I think it's easy on some level to kind of like eye roll and be like, oh yeah, soul document, like very, very Anthropic. But I kind of agree with Marina. Like out of all the models that are currently operating, Claude's just the most pleasant to interact with right now. And I don't know, I guess what I want to talk to you about is like, obviously you have a very literary bent from your guest appearances on the show. And I guess I'm really curious about like whether or not like the way these documents are written have something to do with like this sort of like very hard to quantify quality that we like in something like Claude.
Yeah. So actually reading the soul document was so interesting because I agree with you there, Tim, that the nicest model to chat to I've always found has been Claude for the last couple of models. I'm thinking of myself when I prompt a large language model. I'll read it back, my prompt, and I'll think, if I gave this to a human, am I giving them a decent chance that they could actually perform the task I'm asking them to do? Am I giving them enough information? So if I, you know, I'm editing a document and I just respond and say, make it better, well, that hasn't really given the model a very good idea of what to do, right? So I try to be quite specific. So I was interested to see what Anthropic we're going to include in this soul document that would really guide the model. And the part that I read where it said, Anthropic generally believes, this is from the soul document, it generally believes it might be building one of the most transformative and potentially dangerous technologies in human history, yet presses forward anyway. And I'm thinking, if I tell that to a human, that I'm building the most potentially dangerous history thing in history ever, how does that human proceed? I have no idea. So how that model is supposed to take that information and do something with it, well, I'm looking forward to finding out.
Krish, maybe I'll give you the last comment here. You know, and this kind of goes to sort of what I was just asking Martin about is like, how much is what's in here actually impacting model behavior? And how much of it is kind of, you know, poetic license or almost like literary flourish, I feel is like, this document's a real pleasure to read. But I think where I'm left with it at the end of the day is like, well, how much of this actually impacts like how the model behaves?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does have an effect, certainly. So could it have been more concise? Maybe. I think a few different interesting parts. One is that they do discuss uncertainty, value uncertainty, and calibration, and these sort of things in there. And as people, I mean, most of the things that we encounter in life, we're also uncertain about. We don't know what we believe until we kind of like encounter it. And the fact that they're like going through all of that sort of uncertainty, or like in this case, like how should you reason about it, is actually a nice thing. And that can't be done, I mean, very, very concisely. So I think that's an aspect of it. Another thing I've been waiting this whole like podcast history for to talk about a little bit is some of the moral philosophy aspects as well. I think there's a little bit of confusion in, like, it's very Anthropic-y, as you just said, but if you step back and look at kind of the philosophy of it, maybe it's trying to do too many things at the same time. And there's this concept of kind of dualism and non-dualism in a lot of moral philosophy, that is the soul of individuals separate for each individual, or is it kind of all like universal, all the same thing? And I don't want to get too philosophical, but it's important here. And the reason it is because every instance that a person uses the model, it's kind of like a new birth. It's a new session. And so, like, is this soul document really meant to be, like, universal, or is it meant to be kind of individualized for the session? And if it's really meant to be universal, then why is it talking about being a brilliant friend? Then, because every context needs to have a separate sort of soul in that case. So it's just like very confusing of like what the exact goal actually should be.
Well, and so what's the end result? Do you feel like that's a problem for the model?
If you just use it for like this very narrow sort of type of use, then it's fine. But if it's really a general purpose technology that you're going to use in a lot of different situations, then I think it's like too prescriptive in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a good reminder question. I didn't know you wanted to talk about that. We should definitely, I'm going to work out an MOE segment next year where we just do moral philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it'd make for like a super fascinating episode. Marina, I thought of one last question, so maybe we'll actually have the last word go to you. You know, a few years ago, I know I was very excited about prompting because I was like, okay, for someone who, you know, has over time become more of a writer than a coder, like this is like very exciting. And at the time, I had a couple of researcher friends who were like, don't invest too much in prompting. We're going to figure out how to automate it. Prompting's going away. It's just like a temporary thing. And here we are at the end of 2025. You know, the architects of AI have done their thing and AI is bigger than ever. And if anything, the fact that Anthropic is doubling down so hard on this kind of document, which specifies, as Chris said, the moral philosophy of these models, are we going to be living with prompting for much longer? Or is this kind of similarly just like a temporary thing in your point of view?
Prompting is a way to get information into the model. It is certainly a very simple and straightforward way. Doesn't mean that you know what effect it has when you get it in. But I will say that a lot of times when you go in these larger systems, the prompting does kind of start to dial down, where the prompting is, yeah, maybe you specify slightly what you want, but the way that you actually end up executing is not via prompt. You end up telling the model roughly, oh, I kind of want you to do this. And then there's other intermediate steps. Oh, now I'm going to do this. So instead of prompt engineer, you end up with like, you know, agentic flow engineer. And so, yes, prompting in this sense is going to be part of it because then you're trying to get information into the model in a particular way. But I agree with your friends back then who were like, yeah, we're gonna figure this out. Because remember where we started? We started with you prompted and you put in two spaces instead of one space, and the model just like, I don't know what to do. I don't understand. Okay, we got past that, but the...
Yeah, it's good.
we're okay now. But the base idea remains sort of, you know, the same of like, look, you're trying to get information. The model either can, you know, kind of figure out what you mean, or it can't quite figure out what you mean. And now it just won't tell you that it couldn't figure out what you meant, and it, you know, continues to keep going. But I think we are going to be moving beyond this in terms of ways to inject information into the models. And as we go beyond the models, ways to inject the information that we want into the use of the models. The models themselves are a means to an end most of the time, right? So especially as Chris was referring, you know, enterprise solutions and real use case solutions are going to be a means to an end. And at that point in time, yeah, we're going to be moving beyond something as fragile as prompting.
And also, I guess, come to think of it, like these types of finding tuning approaches as well, right? Where you take a soul document and try to fine tune it in. So,
yes.
Yeah. Incredible episode. This ties together like so many threads from the last 12 months. Martin, Kush, Marina, thanks for joining us so late in December. And that's all the time that we have for today. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.